Today is October 28th, 2020. My name is Michael Martin, and I am interviewing Jessica Southia over Zoom for my first year seminar class at Marshall University. Our FYS class has been focusing on the themes of critical thinking, the power and value of asking well-crafted questions, storytelling, and the stories we tell in response to those well-crafted questions. We've examined oral histories relating to two timely themes, pandemics and protests. This interview will be focused on the theme of protests. Ms. Southia, thank you for agreeing to be interviewed.
I am very happy to be here.
So starting with a introductory question, what was your life like when you were young before you decided to start teaching?
So I grew up in north central West Virginia in a little town called Philippi, West Virginia. Philippi's claim to fame is that most historians have cited Philippi as being the site of the first land battle of the Civil War. And we have a historic covered bridge in Philippi. It's the only covered bridge that, like a major highway, runs through, that runs through Philippi, West Virginia. So Philippi was originally a mining town. There's also a small college in Philippi called Alderson Broaddus University. It's also where I went to college. And I grew up outside of Philippi on a farm up on top of a mountain in a community called Mount Liberty. And I grew up with a single mom who was also a teacher. And everyone in my family works in education or farms or worked in the coal mines. I come from a long line of teachers and coal miners. So like I said, single mom. We grew up in a single wide trailer at the edge of my grandfather's farm, my brother and I. And I spent a lot of my days as a child helping my grandfather farm, and we were very involved in our church. We did a lot of community organizing and charity work through our church. Some of my favorite childhood memories are spending like Christmas or Thanksgiving delivering food baskets or visiting shut-ins. So when people ask me how I got into organizing, or you know, how I became an activist, I always cite these times I spent with my grandfather specifically, working with people in our community who were shut-ins, who were sick, or who needed help in some way. And so I always worked also around it. I grew up around education. I grew up listening to people talk about education all the time around Sunday dinner, around the table. You know, I grew up running around gymnasiums and football fields, helping my mom and my aunts and uncles, you know, who were coaches with practices and take tickets at football games. So all of that was ingrained in me from the beginning.
Okay. So I feel like you might have already answered this, but what made you want to become a teacher?
Well, you know, some people are like, did you always know you wanted to be a teacher? And I always did feel a calling to working with people and working in service in some way. But when I was a kid, I grew up on a farm and with horses and cows, and I wanted to be a large animal vet for a long time when I was little. So I didn't really start feeling the yearn to work in education or as a teacher till I got to high school. As a child growing up, I really thought that I was going to be a horse veterinarian and live on a big horse farm and marry a cowboy, and my life was going to be like an old western all the time. And then when I was in high school, I started sort of realizing that I really, really like working with young people, and I like teaching, I like organizing, I like planning events, and I loved writing, and I've always been a strong reader, and I've always loved reading, and I started making that connection between being a teacher and knowing that you get the opportunity every day to literally make the world a better place. My actions every day directly impact like 100 other people, for good or bad, hopefully though for good. And so it was when I was in high school that I started understanding truly the impact that really great teachers have on not just the kids in their classroom, but their communities, and then eventually the world around them. And so that's when I started, I think, shifting away from working in some sort of animal medicine to working in education.
Nice. So before the strike, what was teaching in West Virginia like?
So teaching has always been hard. And I think that one of the things that Hollywood gets wrong about teaching is that teaching is heavily romanticized in movies and books and, you know, like Dead Poets Society, you climb up on a desk and cite, "Oh, Captain, my Captain," and suddenly everyone's learning literature in your course. Or, like, Dangerous Minds, or that movie where Hilary Swank saved the world with her notebook. What's that one called, where she's teaching in, like, the inner city? So we have this romanticized idea that teaching is all this emotion and power and passion, and every day is just, like, some revelatory experience where you're changing, you know, where you're changing kids' lives through, like, these passionate, powerful moments. And it is that. But it's also a lot of really hard work and a lot of long hours. And I think that's the thing that folks don't see or folks don't get, is how much time and how much crafting takes place behind the scenes. Teaching is all of those things. It is all the passion, and it is all the emotion, and it is all the world changing that you see romanticized in, like, Hollywood films, but it's also an art form. Teachers work to figure out the best way to develop instruction and to deliver instruction, the same way that writers practice writing, musicians practice making music, athletes practice free throws. Teachers are doing that kind of prep work to deliver quality instruction. And so there's, like, some nuts and bolts, and there's some long hours, and there's failures. And then couple that with that in most places, teacher salaries are not in the top tier of professional salaries. And so in a lot of states, teachers aren't making what we would consider to be a living wage, a wage where you could adequately support yourself and your family. And so when you couple the hardness of this work, the difficulty of the work, with the low pay and, in a lot of states, inadequate health care, it creates a lot of struggle for folks who should be some of the most supported members of our society, in my opinion. So I think that, like, before the strike in West Virginia, all teachers know the work is difficult, but what we saw in the 10 years leading up to the strike was a gradual erosion of professional support, chipping away at salary, cost of living going up, cost of medical care going up, but salaries never increasing more than maybe a percentage point here or there. And then we started seeing these radical changes in our healthcare system. Co-pays going from $25 to $50 to even $100. And the anecdote that I often cite when I talk about the lead up to the strike was the winter before the work stoppage in 2018. I have three children. My kids and I all got sick, and we thought we had a cold, but my daughter, who's my oldest, got a really sore throat, so we took her to the urgent care on a Sunday, $100 copay, she got tested for everything, and everything came back negative, and so the doctor said, probably just a really bad cold, go home and rest. Well, that week, my whole family was knocked down. I mean, you know what it's like when you get just a really horrible, like, bug, and you're all just achy and sick and fevered. And the wild thing about being a teacher is you're so worn out all of the time. I spent a lot of that week going, like, wow, am I really this sick, or is teaching really just kicking my butt this week? And so toward the end of that week, with my whole family just being down and out the whole week, the doctor called us and said, hey, we sent your daughter a strep test away, and it came back, and it came positive. Addie has strep. And so I said, oh, man, my whole family's, you know, fever, body aches, sickness. And he was like, wow, you guys all probably have strep. You all need to come in and get swabbed. So I take my whole family of five back into the doctor. In order to get swabbed for strep that the doctor already suspected we had to pay a copay for every person. So my two sons, myself, and Mr. Southia, $100, $100, $100. Then we all needed a course of antibiotics. Now, this was just strep throat. This was just a nasty virus in strep throat. This wasn't even cancer. It wasn't diabetes. It wasn't you know, life-threatening illnesses like some folks in the state fight and are fighting right now. Mm-hmm. And so by the end of that visit that winter, we had paid almost $700 in co-pays and prescriptions just to treat strep throat. Just to treat strep throat, a very treatable course of antibiotic illness. My whole family cost was close to $700. And I think that was the moment for my husband and I where we knew we couldn't go on, that something had to change in the system we were working in, because it was unsustainable for us as a family to have that kind of medical cost for something as simple as strep.
Yeah. So what was the moment you kind of realized that, like, you had to go on strike? That was, like, the only option left was strike.
So there was a lot of lead-up to the strike that I think was good. I think it helped everybody understand that teachers were trying very hard to make striking or stopping school the last possible option. So there were a lot of rallies on Saturdays, a lot of honk and wave picket signs after school, before school. I spent some time, many evenings and Saturdays, on the phone with lawmakers, talking about healthcare, talking about salary, talking about the work of a teacher. I went down and did some in-person lobbying in Charleston, like tried to meet with my lawmakers. I went to town halls that my lawmakers were holding in Berkeley County. And then Mingo County decided to have what they called Fed Up Friday. So, and if you know, like, the history of labor and coal in West Virginia, you know, Mingo is the site of several labor uprisings in the coal industry in West Virginia history. And so there's a long and deep tradition there of workers standing up for their rights and standing up to institutionalized oppression. And so Mingo County and some of the southern West Virginia coal counties actually led the charge by having what they called Stick Out Friday. So all the workers, all the teachers and service personnel called in sick, and they had to cancel school because they didn't have enough teachers to cancel school. So the Stick Out Fridays that they had in Mingo, this happened in early February. They did about two or three of those. And when they had, I remember the second one, I walked into our library at Spring Mills, and I looked at our librarian, and I said, I can't believe that we haven't gone with Mingo. And she said, I know. And I said, what do you want to do? And she said, let's have a meeting. And we met that day after school, and I knew the teachers that I worked with were ready to walk out and take a stand. And some of the situation for us in the Eastern Panhandle is a little bit more nuanced, I think, too, even than the rest of the state, because what we deal with in the Eastern Panhandle of West Virginia, so you guys know this is West Virginia, I'm not giving you the bird. Over here where we live, in the Eastern Panhandle, we're bordered by Maryland and Virginia. And both of those states pay significantly more in teacher salary. I could leave Spring Mills High this year and go teach in Washington County, Maryland, and almost double my salary. And so what we suffer in the Eastern Panhandle is not just the low salary of West Virginia teachers, but a consistent and constant turnover of teachers leaving. I have taught with almost a completely different math department every year the school's been open because our math teachers keep leaving to other states for higher salary. They're not moving. They're just driving 20 minutes across the river to make $20,000 more than what they're making here. And so for folks in the Eastern Panhandle, I think some of the sense of urgency came from we are so tired of losing our best teachers, of watching people come to teach in Berkeley and then leave for greener pastures in Maryland and Virginia. So I think teachers in the Eastern Panhandle were as or more ready to strike than in some other parts of the state because we've seen this constant teacher turnover from our low salary.
Yeah. So once the strike started, how would you describe your role in the strike overall?
So so when the strike started, I wrote a blog post that went viral. And as a result of that blog post, it was called What We Deserve. I wrote it for the West Virginia Council of Teachers of English, and it tried to put the strike in context for people. What I tried to do was harness the power of story. A lot of people didn't and still don't understand the miracles that teachers work. they didn't and still don't understand that teachers are working as hard or harder than a lot of other professions and professionals with the same amount of degrees and education and schooling, but are making a fraction of what other professionals make. And some of this is inherent misogyny and sexism in our society, that teaching and nursing are occupations primarily filled by women. And so there is this element of, well, women are caretakers. They're in it for the kids. We don't have to treat them like we treat other professionals because they're sweet and they're kind and they're motherly and they're, you know, they would go take care of the kids no matter what they got paid. Well, that's true to a degree, but also I'm a professional and with a very highly specialized degree of training to instruct in a subject. And I think I can do that better than a lot of people, and I think there are a lot of people that make a lot more money than me that could not do my job as effectively as I do it. And so there is that element of sexism and misogyny that plays into how people view the teaching and the nursing profession. So what I tried to do was harness the power of story at the beginning of the strike. So I wrote this blog post about the context of the teacher strike and being from West Virginia and being from a teacher family and watching the erosion of pay and benefits over years, and then talked about what teachers do and the miracles we work and the importance of the role of teachers in society. And so that post, really, it got shared thousands of times, and Belt Magazine picked it up and ran a version of it online. And then Elizabeth Catt, the author of What You're Getting Wrong About Appalachia, reached out. She asked if she could share it in a few lectures that she was giving. And so what I saw happening was that people were moved by effective communication, but also the power of story and being able to effectively tell your story. So what I tried to do was tell the teacher's story as often as I could to whomever I could. Any reporter that wanted to talk, I was willing to talk. Anybody who wanted to interview a teacher, I volunteered to take that interview. Did the radio need someone? Go ahead and send me. So what I tried to do was to effectively distribute what I thought was the pathos and the ethos of the teacher story to as many people and places as possible, but then also organize in my local county and lead in my local county in a way that made people feel united and that we were all in this together. So also provide support and leadership to the teachers that were striking here.
Yeah. So do you have a favorite memory from the strike?
I have a couple. So one of them is about food. So the community was so supportive, and everyday people were bringing food, and it was like pizza. And I wrote this article called Pizza is the Currency of Love about the strike, because it was wonderful, and we felt so supported, but like by day 8 of pizza, we were like, please, Lord, I can't eat one more slice of pizza. And so there was this one morning, and it was freezing cold, and I was so tired, and literally every day of the strike, I felt every emotion. Like, I was enraged and despairing and joyful and laughing and sad and regretful. And I mean, like, literally, I felt every emotion every day at some point. And I was wrung out from it. All the time, I was so tired. I was so tired and just so emotionally tired. And that emotional labor really, I mean, it really wears you down. And so I was so tired and I was so cold. And I went over to the snack table and there was just all this pizza. And I just like got a little teary because I just didn't want to eat another slice of pizza. It sounds so ungrateful. And I'm not. I'm very grateful for all that pizza. But I was just like, oh my God, there's just all this pizza here. And I'm so cold and tired and hungry. And I looked over and in the corner of the table there was this pan covered in foil. And it was like 9 in the morning. And I was like, what is in this pan? And I lifted it up. And it was homemade shepherd's pie, like hot, steaming, homemade shepherd's pie, like mashed potatoes, peas, ground lamb, like homemade shepherd's pie. And I was like, I just started going, is this homemade shepherd's pie? Did someone bring us homemade shepherd's pie? Like, I couldn't, it just, like, came from nowhere. No one saw it arrive. No one saw it be dropped off. And so I get a bowl, and I scoop out this shepherd's pie, and it's just steaming and hot, and there's, like, brown gravy dripping off of it, and it tasted like home and happiness and love. And I start weeping into this shepherd's pie, like, openly sobbing. I'm crying right now thinking about it. Into the shepherd's pie, because at 9 in the morning, for it to still be hot, I knew somebody somewhere was like, you know what these teachers need? These teachers need some mashed potatoes and some gravy. And someone got up at, like, 6 in the morning and browned meat and mashed potatoes and baked us this wonderful homemade, home-cooked meal and brought it to us at 9 in the morning. And it was just so sweet and wonderful, and I've always been so touched by it because no one ever knew where it came from. I cry about the shepherd's pie every time, and it's just a weird thing that no one gets but me. But, yeah, so no one knew where the shepherd's pie came from. My other favorite memory is Jim Justice went on this statewide listening tour in the middle of the strike, and he was so out of touch with what was happening and how angry people were. And he decided to have a town hall at Spring Hills High School. Mm-hmm. And so we weren't sure if we could even go in to listen because we were picketing. Spring Hills High was our place of work, and we were picketing outside. And even for a negotiation, you don't cross the picket line. So some of us wanted to go listen. Some of us weren't sure if we should go listen. We weren't sure what to do. And so there is a teacher I work with named Rose Wolfrey, and you know Miss Wolfrey, Michael, and she's a math teacher, and she's from Logan County, West Virginia. And she has deep coal roots in West Virginia. You know, she's a Manhigh hillbilly, and she, you know, she has family from Buffalo Creek. She has some great stories of growing up in, you know, being a child of a coal community. And so Rose, I would refer to as my strike mother, because she would come to the strike lines, and she had this big walking stick, like walking staff, like Mother Jones, and she would just sort of give us direction about how to be on strike, because she had all these memories of watching, you know, the men in her family in the coal mine strike in southern West Virginia. So we go to Rose, and we're like, Rose, what should we do? And she has her staff, and she's like, well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to pick 10 of you to go, and you guys are going to go in as a coalition. You're the Rose Coalition, and you're the coalition who's going in to negotiate. So she, like, tapped, like, I think there were 8 of us that went. It was me and Chris Galladay and Craig Arch and Andrew Donato and Ms. Hilliard and Tanya Fleming. Oh, my God, I'm leaving some folks out. There were about 8 or 10 of us that she tapped. And she was like, so if anybody questions why you crossed the picket line, we'll just tell them that I sent you in as a coalition of negotiators, and you're the Rose Coalition. And I mean, like, we called ourselves the Rose. We still call ourselves the Rose Coalition, that group of people to this day. And so we then we marched in. Like, we marched in together, like a little militia. You know, the strike ending and not getting everything we wanted, but getting the 5% raise certainly helped. I do wish that we had come to some sort of consensus about PEIA, but you know, going back to work and feeling victorious is also another one of my favorite memories.
Okay. So since we were just on the topic of Jim Justice, how do you feel the West Virginian government handled the strike?
I mean, I think they handled it terribly. I think they thought that they were dealing with an uninformed, biddable mass of ladies that they could send back to work. And I don't think they were prepared for how smart teachers were. Well, I mean, I heard that quite a bit when I would go to the Capitol to talk to lawmakers. I can't get over how articulate you are. You're so well-spoken. You know, from male lawmakers, shocked that I can talk about policy or, you know, my job so well. So I don't think that West Virginia lawmakers were prepared for how prepared West Virginia teachers were to advocate for themselves. I don't think Jim Justice really has a grip on what needs to happen to move the state forward. I don't think a lot of our lawmakers do. I think there's been, since the strike, some really extraordinary shifts. I'm so glad that we're electing people like Daniel Walker in Mon County, Sammy Brown in Jefferson County, folks that are ready to move progressively into the future. I think that if West Virginia has any hope of turning things around and making this a place that young people want to stay, I think that we need to start electing lawmakers who have a vision for some radical, bold change. And I don't think the current majority right now does.
All right. So it's been 2 years, almost three, coming up almost on three next February, since the protests. How do you feel that teaching has changed since then?
I feel like teachers are a lot more united. I feel like teachers are a lot more willing to advocate for themselves. My colleague, Mrs. Hilliard, and I were just discussing how there's a lot more conversation about self-care in the teaching profession than there's ever been. And I think that's good. I think that's a good conversation to have. You know, when I first became a teacher, it was sort of like, suck it up, buttercup. Take your low pay and get to work and don't make any noise about it. So I think there's a lot more advocacy happening. I think teachers are a lot more engaged in the political process. A lot more teachers involved in trying to elect pro-public education candidates, which I think is good. So engagement, I think, in current issues and events and policy making. So those are all pretty positive changes, I think.
So to end, to shift away from the protests to end this, I have some questions that relate to my first year seminar class.
Okay.
So my first year seminar class is focused on critical thinking. Do you have an example of critical thinking, that times you had to use critical thinking in your line of work, like a specific example where you had to use critical thinking in teaching?
Sure, yeah. Every day, I'll try to come up with a good specific one, but I heard once that teachers make as many minute-by-minute decisions as like a heart surgeon, and I don't think that's hyperbole. So I think teachers every day have to rely on critical thinking to adjust and respond to the students in front of you when a lesson isn't working, or something falls flat, or technology doesn't connect, or smart bulb bulbs blow out. So an example of how I've had to use critical thinking on my feet, like in my classroom or like in advocacy work?
Whatever you'd like to, whatever story you'd like to tell.
Okay. Huh. I wish I would have thought about it. Like, this is one of those questions where I feel like there's so many examples. It's, like, so big. I'm trying to think of a good example of where I've really, really pieced together something for you. And can we come back to this one? I can't believe that I'm blanking on the critical thinking question.
Sure. So the last question I have to add is just simply, is there anything that you would like to add that I haven't asked yet?
Oh, okay. So the critical thinking really is the last question, because I think you've done a great job. This was a really good interview.
Thank you.
I don't think there's one thing I would add to this. All right. So, man, there are just so many things that just like with the critical thinking. I can give you a real generic example of like completely refitting a lesson that wasn't going as planned, or I don't know. I feel like this question, Michael, is one where I could be like, I am using critical thinking literally every minute of every day. Can you be more specific? Like today, when only six of my class came to my virtual lesson on Zoom, I then had to go back and look and make sure my directions were clear, and then think, how can I engage these students that did not come in a way that will make the lesson accessible and equitable? So then I had to go back into the lesson and film part of it, and then create a hyper document that I uploaded with the film, so that, and then send out a mass update to all the students who didn't attend the virtual class that, hey, if you missed class, here is a virtual version. And that was just like today. So that's kind of like just one example of every day where a teacher has to use critical thinking to solve a problem in her classroom. I don't know. I've failed the critical thinking question. I did great until the end.
I think that's a great example of critical thinking. So before I end this interview, is there anything else you'd like to say?
No. Just that if I've learned any lessons from the last few years, it has been that the most important thing that you have is your voice, and you should always advocate for yourself. And nobody knows your job or your story better than you, and you are the person that should be telling it all the time. And so if you ever feel like you're in a situation where you're being treated unfairly, or you're in a situation where you feel like you're not getting what you deserve, then you need to tell the world about it in some way, and to quote Jim Justice, in some way, shape, fashion, or form.
I think that's a great point. I think that is a perfect note to end on. I'd like to thank you for allowing me to do this interview with you.
I'm happy to do it.
Thank you. Okay, so I have just finished.